We are on page 690. We didn't finish the Menorah yet. So we're going to start Pasuk Dalad. Perichov Dalad, Pasuk Dalad. Okay, until now, the Pasuk was saying that Hashem said to the Yidin, take you the Shem and Zayas to Moshe Rabbeinu, pressed to give light, Lahalis Ner Tamid, and where it should be lit, and so on and so forth. So last week we discussed, in a spiritual sense, the whole concept of the Menorah, the way Menorah is lit Tamid, even though it's only Erev HaBeker, it refers to the Neshama of every Jew. You need Moshe Rabbeinu to kindle the Menorah of every Jew. Sometimes a Jew needs to be pressed, tortured, to be able to get the pure olive oil that the Jew needs, and the menorah of the Jew has to be constantly lit. Okay, so the last pasuk says, of pasuk dalet of this paragraph, ala menorah tahara, on the pure menorah. Now what does it mean, the pure menorah? So Rashi brings down two interpretations. One interpretation is pure gold. Pure means gold. Or pure means that the menorah had to be cleaned every day. Okay? So Rashi is in both interpretations. Number one, that it was pure gold, not mixed with any other metals. And the menorah had to be cleaned every day before you put in the new oil and the new wicks. So that's why it's called the pure menorah. Yarech HaSaneiris, they should arrange the lamps. Lefnei Hashem Tamid, it should be constantly before Hashem. And like we learned, Tamid in a simple sense means if it's done every day, it's called Tamid, even though it doesn't mean 24/7. Even though the Ner Maravi, we learned, did last. The one candle did last for 24/7.
I don't know what to clean.
Huh? When they lit the menorah, so there was like, when you, like Hanukkah, you have to clean out the glass or, yeah, but it gets dirty from the wick and from the black, from the ashes. So you have to clean it out. They had to clean out the menorah every day and refill the oil and we make a new wick. In the Beis HaMikdash, they had to use new wicks every night. And it's interesting, where did they get the wicks from? So it says, they got the wicks from the old clothing that the Kohanim wore. The Kohanim wore, the Kohanim wore the white clothing, the linen. So they would cut them up into strips, and that's what they used for wicks. It was interesting, because it wasn't because they were cheap to buy, you know, proper wicks, because as we know the world, there was no poverty in the place of wealth. But there was a spiritual aspect of kindling the menorah. The wicks of the menorah should be from the garments of the Kohen Gadol. Because it was done with it a mitzvah once, you know, you do with it a mitzvah a second time. Okay, now, the Torah is speaking about the chalas, the lechem upon him. Okay? And we'll soon see the connection between the menorah and the lechem upon him, because these two paragraphs, page 690, the connection between these two paragraphs, because they seemingly don't fit in here, you know, when it's talking about Pesach and Shavuos and Sukkot, and then afterwards it's speaking about a Jew that cursed God, and in the middle you have about the menorah and the shulchan, so we'll discuss that when we get there. Okay, lakachta seilis. Huh?
Hanukkah.
Well, not really.
After all the chagim, and then you come.
Okay, you're talking that. Okay, fine. And the shulchan. We'll see. But no, it's a good point that you made. After the Yom Tov, you get Hanukkah. Maybe the shulchan is Purim. The bread, we'll figure it out. Okay, lakachta seilis. You should take fine flour. Va'afisa esa, you should bake it, shtei mesrei chalis, 12 chalis, shnei esreinim yia chalo echos. There should be, each loaf was 86.4 eggs. They're big loaves of bread, by the way. 86 is double, twice 86, it was like 100, 86.4 is 87, times 4 is 28, 32, 348 ounces per loaf.
Wow.
says each loaf was the volume of 86.4 eggs. Now each egg is 2 ounces. It was 86. No, I'm sorry. 86.4 times 2.
170.
But
there's no
flour? No, that was the flour. No, this is the size of
the loaf.
They made it as matzah. It wasn't baked. It looked like bread, but it wasn't baked like bread. It was baked like matzah.
You said every egg was 2 ounces.
Every egg is 2 ounces. Every loaf was 86.4 eggs.
But is it eggs? Flour? It's not eggs.
The size of eggs, not eggs. No, they didn't put eggs. The size of an egg.
Not the recipe.
Okay, I have to
try
that. But not like thin matzah. Like
it was thick, but it was matzah. It didn't have time to rise. Okay, now, every Friday, this is the way it worked. Every Friday, 12 loaves of bread were baked. They were put on the table the next day on Shabbos. On Shabbos, they took off the last week's breads that were baked the week before, and they put on the new loaves. Now, every Shabbos, the shifts of Kohanim in the Beis Hamikdash change. So it says, the Kohen Gadol got half the chalos, and the other Kohanim split the other loaves. But half of it went to the group that left, and half went to the Kohanim that came in. So next week, again, the Kohanim that were leaving got half, and the Kohanim that came in got half. So they got half 1 week, and then the another half the other week. So it's 12 loaves of bread, 1 second. They were shaped rectangularly, and then when it was a rectangular bread. It wasn't a pull apart, round. It was a rectangular challah, and the chalas went up on the end 2 tefachim high, between 6 to 8 inches high. That means they were flat like this, and then they went up like this, and they were actually in a form, in a shape of the pans. So therefore, it said like this: the breads were placed on the table of Ishabis. Miraculously, the old breads, which were divided amongst the Kohanim and eaten, remained fresh all week. That means without preservatives. When they put took the old chalas off of the Friday before, a week, 9 days, it was as fresh and they were warm as if it was just taken out. What?
Doesn't say where they bake it.
The Torah doesn't say, but the Gemara says they had a bakery there. Now, according to the Sifurna, when so the question, why is he saying this now? So the Sifurna says like this: when they finished the Menorah, the Mishkan, there was a supply of flour for showbread. Miraculously, Hashem gave him a gift of flour. That supply was used up, so now Moshe Rabbeinu was commanded by Hashem to make new flour, and it had to be very fine flour. There's different levels of flour in Hebrew. There's Seles, there's Kemach. Seles is the finest flour. You know, the purest flour. And that's what they made the breads from.
What did you think?
They're matzah. They weren't chometz. We said. 1 second. Each loaf was about 86.5. The loaves are mixed and kneaded outside of the courtyard, but baked as matzah inside the courtyard, like all the loaves of meal offerings. They were baked on Friday, put into the place on Shabbos, onto the table. Okay? Now the Shulchan, if you remember when we learned earlier, okay? In fact, let's look at the picture. I believe there's a picture here. We'll understand it better. Here. If you see on page 449, right? So that's, and page 449 is a picture of the Shulchan. Okay? So the Shulchan, the way the breads were, it was 6 on one side, 6 on the other side of the Shulchan. Okay? So you see there's 6 trays over there. But they're actually forms. In fact, look in the, also on 449 on the bottom, on the top right of the bottom half of the page.
In the middle
The middle of the page, yeah, you're correct. Yeah. That's a picture of the lechem upon him showbread. That's how it looked. Okay, it was rectangular and came up 2 tefachim on each side. And that was what the Torah is speaking about here. So every week they baked, you take a piece of shtemasir chalas, and you have to bake it. Shnei asreinim was one challah. And like we said, each challah was 86 times 2 is 212, 192 plus the 4, it was like 195 ounces each bread weighed.
Only the Kohanim
eat this? What's unique, what's very interesting, this is the only thing that the Mizbeach didn't have anything from. Normally, you had a carbon, the Mizbeach had a part of it, everything. This is the only thing, therefore we'll soon learn there was a certain kamitza, a certain handful of flour that they did burn on the Mizbeach. But the actual showbread, the 12 chalas, yeah, would not, or were only eaten by the Kohanim. The Mizbeach, Hashem, so to speak, had nothing of it. By the way, the many tzaddikim, it's not our minig, but many great tzaddikim on Shabbos used to have 12 chalas. Instead of, we have 2 chalas, right? Like a Mishnah. But they would have 12 chalas corresponding with this 12 chalas of the lechem upon him.
But did they eat?
No.
No, it corresponds with this, the 12 breads. If they ate so much, it depends how big they were. I mean, the people, not the...
They were big.
Only the Kayanim. There wasn't that much tea. There wasn't that much. If you think about it. Yeah. Okay. Now the pasuk continues. He says, "V'samta eisam pasuk vav. V'samta eisam shtayim arachis. You put them in 2 stacks. Sheish amarachis. 6 in a stack because there are 12 loaves, right? And if you look at the picture on again 449. The shulchan was divided into 2, 6 and 6. So the Torah says you have 12 loaves, 6 on each side. Ala shulchan ator lifnei Hashem, and the pure shulchan which was before Hashem. Now, again, what is again the word shulchan hatohar? So like we learned in the previous pasuk by the Menorah Torah, 2 things Rashi says. Number 1, it was pure gold, right? Not made with anything else. And secondly, that what it means, ala shulchan, the bottom loaf was sitting directly on the table. Then it went, the shelves and but the bottom challah was mamish on the table itself.
So then there was a start from bottom, or did they?
No, they were put from the bottom first, and then
they took from the bottom first.
No, when they put it on the table, first they put it on the bottom on the table, then they put it on the racks going up. When they divided it, I don't know which way they took it. I don't know.
They didn't put it straight on the racks. They put it on a special plate. No,
the bottom challah went directly on the table. Mm-hmm. Then there were the racks with the plates that they, yeah.
Oh, they use on the table?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why 12? The reason why it could be 12 is maybe because of the 12 tribes. I mean, I didn't see anybody saying the reason. But it says it could be because of the 12 tribes. So each tribe representing the 12 tribes. Now, Pasuk Zion says like this: "Nesata l'mareches on the ma'arecha." We'll soon see what this means. Levena zaka, you put a pure Levain is a type of spice here, they call it frankincense, on each stack, meaning like this. A bowl of frankincense was placed on top of each of the 2 sacks, each bowl containing a kremitz, 3-finger fistful of the spice. The incense was called a commemoration because it was the only part of the showbread that was burnt on the Mizbeach. Okay? The fact that this part of the meal offering was burnt on the altar is why the showbread, none of it, when on the altar is called a fire offering. Okay? It was on top of it. Now, this is a machlekes between Rashi and Rambam. According to Rashi, this handful of this levaina, the spice, was...
It's closed?
No, it was a certain type of frankincense. That was, according to Rashi, it was on top of each stack. That means there are two stacks of six challahs. They had two handfuls. One was put on the top challah of each one. According to the Rambam, that's what Rashi learns. According to the Rambam, it was not on top of the challahs. It was placed on the shulchan next to the challahs, but at the bottom. And it's on the table itself, next to each stack. Because the pasuk says, "V'nasata al hamareches." Mareches means the organized trays, right? Now, Rashi takes it literal. Al hamareches means on top of the mareches. Meaning it was on top of the six challahs. The Rambam learns al means next, and you find many places in Torah al means next. So the Rambam learns it was next to the, it was on the table next to these six columns, you know, the six shelves, and Rashi learns it was on top of it.
You don't know
where you're right? I wasn't there, couldn't tell you. So it says like this, should be remembrance for the bread, Ishel Hashem, this is a burning for Hashem. Okay? Every single Shabbos, this is done. Yachenu lefnei Hashem Tom, it has to be constantly set, arranged before Hashem, because they were constantly on the table. The second you took off the old bread, you put in the new bread. Me'ez b'nei Yisrael, bris elam, it should be an everlasting covenant. Now, why is this called an everlasting covenant? So the Mefarshim explained like this. Shabbos is the bris between Hashem and the Jews. The fact that the challahs were divided by the Kohanim on Shabbos, so it was also a covenant. What's the covenant? It says like this. Just like on Shabbos, a Jew is not supposed to worry about his livelihood. Not supposed to look about parnasa. The Jew is supposed to enjoy the food, because Shabbos is Shabbos, no business. So the same way, this symbolizes... The showbread symbolizes that Hashem gives the person the parnasa. Okay? And we're going to learn, now we start another story in the Chumash, but it says like this, the Mefarshim point, I'm going to say it now, the Mefarshim point out, the Meneira and the Shulchan, Meneira represents Torah, and the Shulchan represents business. Meneira is light, right? Ner mitzvah v'teira or. So Menorah represents wisdom. The Shulchan represents Parnasa. He's making a living. By both, over here, the Torah uses the expression Al HaMenorah HaTahara and Al HaShulchan HaTahara. Which means the Torah is teaching us a lesson that you need to have pure learning of Torah. What's so funny about that? And you need to have pure business, pure parnasa.
The moment you start learning, all of those business comes to your brain.
That means you're not pure.
That's what I laugh.
Okay, it's funny. I mean, what?
Why do we always compare a table to a mizbeach? I always hear people say the table's like a mizbeach at our home.
Because what did the mizbeach do? The mizbeach burnt the sacrifices to Hashem. When a person eats, the food is also being burnt. The digestive system actually burns the food. Okay? And when a person eats, the food that we eat, we're sacrificing to Hashem. What does it mean we're sacrificing it to Hashem? When a person eats, and they eat kosher food, okay, and they eat it for the right purposes, to be healthy, to be able to serve Hashem properly, so that food that we eat is actually, literally, in Tanya, the Alter Rebbe says the expression, ka'ayla u'kakarban, it's actually like a burnt offering. Because what did you took the animal, you brought it on the Mizbeach, we take physical food, and we bring it on the Mizbeach, by utilizing it to serve Hashem properly. That's why there's a lot of similarities. A table needs salt, the karbanis had salt. I mean, all these things, you need to have all the the kedusha and the purity in it. But that's why it says by both expressions. By the menait it says ala menait atahedo in pasuk dalid, and pasuk vav it says ala shulchan hatahor. It needs to be pure. What does it mean? Pure learning and pure business. So it'll take a few minutes to discuss what does this mean in a practical level. Pure learning means that it's God's Torah, which means we don't try to make the Torah good for us.
Example.
I want to do something, show me where the Torah says I could do it. In other words, there's two approaches. Tell me what God really wants me to do. Or another approach is, I want to do it, just find me in the book where it says I could do it. Okay? The Gemara says, there was a Chacham of the Gemara, a great sage of the Gemara, that he had the brilliance to be able to purify a sheretz that we learned about, which is one of, you know, the eight species of dead bugs, which are tamei. He had the Torah brilliance to be able to purify it with 150 halachic reasons. But there was one problem, he said. God said it's tamei. In other words, when we mix our mind and our desires into the learning, then it's not pure. Pure learning means, what does God say? Not what I want God to say. It's a very big difference, by the way. Tell me what Hashem really wants me to do. Don't tell me that Hashem agrees with what I say. Okay? That's pure learning. You can elaborate on that a lot. Pure business is obvious. Number one, you don't cheat, you don't steal, it doesn't take away time from being a religious Jew. That's the definition of a pure shulchan. So by these two concepts, and we'll see what's connected to the next story of the Chumash, these two concepts teach a Jew that learning needs to be pure, and the Torah need, and the business needs to be pure. The shulchan represents food, you know, making a living, parnasa, that has to be pure. Okay, let's see pasuk test. V'ha'is el Aaron ovanov. This will be for Aaron and his children. V'achalu b'makom kadosh. They should eat it in the holy place. And by the way, you see from here that it was only amongst the male kohanim. But here's another interesting thing. The Gemara learns out from this pasuk the following. It says it should be la'aron ulvanov. That means Aaron one half, his children the other half. Which means the Gemara learns out in Yuma. The Kohen Gadol gets half, because he's instead of Aaron, and the rest of the kohanim get the other half. So from the 12 breads, Kohen Gadol got 6, and the other kohanim split 6, 3 for the outgoing group and 3 for the incoming group.
Why Kohen Gadol need so much?
Maybe he was a big person. Maybe he was hungry. I don't know.
They ate it by itself. Or
did they had to eat it by Malkum Kodesh. No, it was they had to eat it only the male kohanim.
But
maybe he had a big appetite. Again, I don't know.
They had to eat it in Beit HaMikdash?
B'makom Kodesh. It says in a holy place, it means they had to be eaten in the Beit HaMikdash. Ki why? Ki Kodesh Kodashim Hulei. This is from a holy of holies, you know, from the Hashem himself. Me'ishi Hashem, from the fires of Hashem. Chok Olam, it's an eternal decree. Okay, so this is, finishes the Lechem Aponim and the story of the Menorah. How it gets into here, so the Mefarshim explain that we started off by speaking about the Yomim Tevim, correct? Then the Torah went into the Menorah and into the Shulchan, the breads. So again, the Mefarshim explain, now that Hashem finished the holiness of the Yom Tov, Hashem says, don't keep the holiness only in the holidays. When you learn Torah, when you have parnasa business, it also needs the holiness of the Yom Tovim. In other words, bring the Chag into the rest of the year. Like we mentioned, I think, once, I don't know where it was. In our Haggadah, you know, a lot of Haggadahs, when you finish the Seder, they say Chad Gadya, and a lot of songs. Okay, Chasal Sidr Pesach. The Alter Rebbe did not put Chasal Sidr Pesach, which literally means the Seder is over, and we did it right, and Hashem should help us, and so on and so forth. The Alter Rebbe did not put that in our Agada, we don't say it, because, as the Alter Rebbe said, Pesach never ends. You know, the Torah is teaching us over here, you need to bring the holiness of the Yom Tov, of the Chag, into day-to-day living. You can't say, okay, now's a holy day, and we'll stay only holy here. It needs to be brought. Every day you have the same thing. You daven in the morning, that's Kedusha. So somebody says, okay, davening goodbye, it's over, now I go into the real world. And davening doesn't affect my real world. So the Torah says, no, you have to bring the holiness of davening, the holiness of learning, into the day. You know, bring the Kedusha, the holiness of it, into your day-to-day living, whether it's studying Lashochan, the Parnas, and so on and so forth. Okay, now the Torah starts with a story. Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelis, a son of an Israelite woman went out. We'll soon see where he went out from. Vuhu ben Ish Mitzri, he was a son of an Egyptian man. That means his mother was Jewish, his father was Egyptian. B'seich b'nei Yisrael, amongst the Jewish people. V'yinotze b'machane, and started a fight in the camp. B'nei Yisraelis, the son of an Israel, this Israel woman. V'isha Yisraeli, and a Jewish man. Put it into a fight. Where did he go out of? What did he do? It said like this. He went out either from his world, he lost his share in the world to come. That's one reason. Another reason was like this. Where did he go out of that he cursed God? What happens? The next part says he cursed Hashem. So what happens like this? He was taken to court, to Beis Din of Moshe Rabbeinu. His mother, as the Pasuk is soon going to say, his mother's name was Shlemis Bas Divri Lamati Don. What happens like this? This Shlemis Bas Divri, and the Torah says her name to show there was one woman out of the entire Jewish nation that was defiled by an Egyptian man. When the Jews were in slavery in Egypt. So this Shlemis Bas Divri was defiled by an Egyptian man, and she gave birth to this man. Doesn't say his name, we'll soon see why it doesn't say any names. But he gave birth to him. The mother was in the tribe of Dun. So now, the question, what tribe did this kid belong to? His mother was Jewish. He was Jewish. He wanted to be amongst the people of Dun. Because his mother was from Dun. His father's tribe were Egyptians, Eregoyim. So he, and Dun said, we don't want you. You're not, your father's not Jewish, we don't want you in our tribe, you don't belong to our tribe. So, he came to Moshe Rabbeinu. Didn't tell you that. What do? You go to Beis Din. They went to Moshe Rabbeinu's Beis Din. Moshe Rabbeinu said, it says in the Torah, Ish Lebeis HaVesov, you go by the father's house, the father's a guy, he does not belong to Shevet Dan. Therefore he has no rights to Shevet Dan. So he walked out of the court guilty, not guilty, but he lost. So he got angry and he got started a fight, and eventually he cursed the...
Egyptian?
No, not the Egyptian. His son, who was Jewish. The Egyptian's out of the picture.
Where did he have to go?
In fact, according to one opinion, Rashi said before, Moshe Rabbeinu killed, that was the Egyptian that Moshe Rabbeinu killed. You know, all the way back into Chumash Meis, Moshe Rabbeinu saw an Egyptian beating up a Jew. Right? What was the story? This Egyptian came to Shlemis Bas Divri, this woman, and defiled her. And the husband came home, and they got into a fight. So the Egyptian was beating up the Jew, who was the husband of the wife that he defiled. So Moshe Rabbeinu beat him up and killed him. That's the story of Chumash Meis.
But they said that he killed him, like, with his eyes.
Okay, how he killed him, whatever. But Moshe Rabbeinu killed him. I didn't say how he killed him.
No, because I wanted to ask a question. Because I said that the blood, so how does it...
Because it depends which opinion you go by.
Okay, so that's my question.
That's my answer.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Where is this son of anybody we want to go? Where it belongs to?
Where does the ger belong to?
He doesn't have a piece of land.
Okay, but here, Rashi says Ish Mitzri. Rashi says like this: This guy, the Egyptian, was beating up the Jew back in when the Jews were in Egypt. V'nasan einaba, he wanted her. V'laila, he threw out the husband from the house, came into the house, defiled her. She thought it was her husband. The guy came home and realized this, so he started beating him up. So Moshe Rabbeinu saw the Egyptian beating up the Jews, Rashi and Chumash. So Moshe Rabbeinu killed him. Okay? So this kid was born from that, from the Egyptian father. So he's dead. He's killed. He had the eschus of being killed by Moshe Rabbeinu. It's an honor, by the way. To be killed by Moshe Rabbeinu is eschus. Must be a special guy. He got killed by Moshe Rabbeinu. So this kid was not a mamzer, by the way, because the guy wasn't Jewish. So even though she was a married woman, but if it's with a guy, the kid's not a mamzer. He wasn't a mamzer. But he said, okay, I need a tribe. So my mother belongs to Don, so I guess I'm tagging on to Don. And Don said, no way, Jose, we're not giving you to Don. So they went to Moshe Rabbeinu's court. The Moshe Rabbeinu said, one second, Rashi says, here. Rashi says like this. It went up in Beis Din and Mechuyev. Why? He wanted, Rashi says like this, over here. Bali ta'ala b'teich machne don. The guy wanted to put his tent, his house, in Don's property. Amalei said, he said to Mativ el Chakan, Don's people, Don said, what are you doing here? Amalei m'nei don ani. I'm from the tribe of Don. He said, no. It says, Ishal digle b'esiv lebeis aveisam. It's only the father. Your father's the guy. You don't belong in Don. So he went to court. V'gatzim mechuyev. Right? And Ahmed v'gadiv said he christened God.
This time it was Jew according to mother or according to father?
At this time it was the mother. If not, he wouldn't be Jewish.
As if he's Jew and he doesn't belong to God. So Dan,
where does he belong? Where does a ger belong?
With Klal Yisrael.
Which tribe does he belong to?
Right.
Certain gate.
Where do we
all
belong?
We belong to a tribe. We belong to a tribe.
You, I don't know where you belong, but your husband belongs in a certain tribe. Right? When Mashiach comes, everybody's going to know which tribe we belong to.
So what happens with the
year? So they're not going to have any actual chelik and righteous role. Like Levi also didn't have.
As where he had to put the tent, he had to sleep in some place.
It wasn't even a gate.
On Santa Monica Boulevard. And the benches, plenty of room. Rashi says, Melamish in his guy, which needs to be understood what that means. Okay. Shh. What? What?
I said that would be with Shevet Levi.
Moshe Rabbeinu with Shevet Levi. No, you go by your husband. Your husband's a Levi?
No.
Okay, so forget it. You're not in my tribe. No. If you put your tent in my thing, I'm going to throw you out.
I'm not putting my tent with yours.
Thank God not. Okay. Let's go. Shh. So the guy, to the Jew that took him to court, to Beis Din, said he started fighting. So what happened? Let's learn a few more psukim and then we'll discuss what happened. Vayikev ben ishi Yisrael, this is a shame. The son of the Israelite woman pronounced the name. He said the name of Yudke Vavke. And he cursed Hashem. The people brought him to Moshe. Obviously, that's why it says here, Beseich b'nei Yisrael. Because there were people that were there. There were witnesses that testified that he did it. Otherwise, you couldn't kill him. So it says, Beseich b'nei Yisrael. There were witnesses that testified. He was obviously warned. Because in order to get death penalty, you need to be warned. Shame Ime, the name of his mother was Shlemis Bazdivri Lamati Don. Okay? Now, according to Halacha, the only time you get killed for cursing, God forbid, cursing Hashem, is only when you said the name of Yudkei Vavkei. If you said any of the other names of Hashem in your cursing, so it was biblically forbidden, but you didn't get capital punishment. And in fact, it's a very interesting Rambam from the Gemara. The Rambam, when he discusses the Dinim, you know, they have to come to Beis Din, right? So the witnesses had to testify in court what they heard, that the guy Chas Hashem cursed God, and they had to say it over. So they had to tear their clothing when they said it, and the Beis Din tore their clothing for hearing that the name of Hashem was cursed. But they had no choice, because they had to testify what the guy said. If they don't testify what the guy said, you can't, you know. There was once a story, they tell a story. I'm going to change the wording to make it a little bit
juicier.
No. More a prize. I don't want to say the word that the guy said. Anyway, so he said, a guy once called somebody an idiot. He called him something worse, but he called him an idiot. The guy came, he was so embarrassed, insulted. The guy called him an idiot. So he went to the Rav to tell him, to snitch on this guy. He said, he called me a name. So the Rav said, what did he call you? He said, I can't say it, it's so bad. And the Rav's trying to get it out of for 5 minutes. Tell me already what the guy says. Finally, the Rav says to him, idiot, tell me what he said. He said, that's what he said. But in fact, in the Gemara, they don't even call it the curse of Hashem, they call it Birchas Hashem.
But they pronounce the Yud Kei Vavkei like we pronounce today, or is it meant to be said
like we said? Those days they said it the real way.
Like we possess.
And today, right. Somebody say like we pronounce, it's not the curse.
Today it is called Shema Mefeirish. There's no death sentence anyway today. Okay. The story is, okay, there is two versions in the Medrash. One version is the version that we said now with the Mati Dan, and you know he cursed Hashem because he was thrown out of court, this case. In the Medrash of Brachia says the following. One of these Jews, the son of the Israelite, went around the camp scoffing at Hashem. What happened? He said, look at this. A king normally eats warm, freshly baked bread. Why should Hashem eat old, cold bread in the Mishkan? He thought God eats the bread. He says, the bread's a week old. It's not nice for God to eat such old bread. So the Jewish man, not the guy from the Jewish mother, a regular Jewish man said to him, why are you speaking so disrespectfully to Hashem? So, you know, it's not nice what you said that Hashem has to eat old bread. It's not nice what you said. So they got into a fight. They beat each other up. And the guy cursed Hashem at that time. So there's two reasons why the guy actually cursed Hashem. The more well-known one is the one Rashi says. But there's also an opinion in the Gemara that they were fighting because the guy said, why does Hashem have to eat old bread? And the guy told him off for speaking like that to Hashem. Okay, now, why does it say that he actually went out to the camp, into the camp? Okay, some of Farshim learned it means Vayetze, he went out into the camp, which explains why he was warned, because witnesses saw it, because he did it out in the camp, he didn't do it in the private place.
Is it the same guy that cursed Hashem?
Yeah.
Who was refused?
Well, it depends which story it was. One story is that he was refused, he cursed, and the other, so the guy that spoke disrespectfully to Hashem. So Mevashim explained like this. What's the connection between these two? Between the story of the cursing and the Menorah and the Shulchan. The story is completely out of place here. So he explained like this. The Torah is teaching us, like we said before, if the Menorah is pure and the business is pure, then you accept things in life without the need to curse. When you start cursing, it's because your learning is not pure, your parnasi, you don't feel your parnasi is pure. And then what happens? You end up murdering, you end up damaging property, you end up cursing, you end up doing all these terrible things. If a person realizes that his wisdom is pure, and his life, his business is pure, is from God, you will never come to these things. And that's why the Torah puts this story next to the Mizbeach, I mean next to the Menorah and to the Shulchan, to teach us this story comes about, because Vayetze ben Isha Yisrael, he left the purity of Torah, and that's what happens when you leave it in the purity of Torah. Because if a person believes, and this is part of the purity of making a living, if a person believes that Parnasa is like the Rebbe Marash said, Parnasa nowadays is like the man that fell from heaven, is completely irrational. You can have brilliant people thinking they're making brilliant deals and they lose everything. You can have a bunch of morons making stupid deals and they're becoming very rich. It's complete illogical, mamish like the man that comes from. What does the man teach us? No matter how much you gathered, you always ended up with only the exact amount. You took too little, there was a brach in it. You took too much, Hashem took it away from you. What does the man mean? The man is complete belief that Hashem will take care of the needs. Exactly what I need, from Hashem's perspective, is what I'm going to get. I'm not going to get more, and I'm not going to get less. People think that in order to make more money in business, I need to cheat. If I don't cheat, how am I going to make a living? That automatically shows that you deny the fact that Parnas is coming from Hashem. And if Parnas is coming from Hashem, as much as you're going to deserve and need, that's what you're going to get. That's when it's pure. Otherwise, and the person vayetze from that, then the person's character is molded in a very negative way, rather than accepting whatever Hashem does. Yeah.
But with Asher, don't you have to work within the nature? In other words, you can't, like, work 1 hour a day and think that you're going to get the parnasah. You have to work with...
You have to make a vessel. The pasuk says, "Ubeirachacha Hashem alakecha b'chol asher ta'ase." Hashem will bless you in everything you do. I mentioned many times there was a story of the Tzemach Tzedek. A chassid once came to the Tzemach Tzedek, asked for a bracha. Tzemach Tzedek gave him a bracha and it didn't work. So the guy basically came for a refund. You know, it didn't work. I want my money back. I don't know if he gave him any money, but the Tzemach Tzedek said to him, a bracha is like rain. The biggest bracha for a farmer is to have rain. But rain is only a bracha when you planted the field, you cultivate the field, you do the... That's when rain is a bracha. If you sleep in bed a whole day, you don't plant the field, you don't plant the field, and the rain comes down, nothing's going to grow. So we said, you know, somebody once gave somebody a bracha to win the lottery, and he didn't win. So he came back, you gave me a... He said, did you buy a ticket? No, I didn't buy a ticket. No, so how do you expect to win if you didn't buy a ticket? I mean, you can get the biggest bracha in the world, you don't buy a ticket, you're not going to win the lottery. There's no way in the world you're going to win the lottery. So the Torah says, "Ubeiracha Hashem alakecha b'chol asher ta'ase." Hashem will bless you and everything, but Chassidus elaborates in many, many different places that if you realize it's Beiracha Hashem alakecha, that the bracha is coming from God, then you understand that the vessel has to be a kosher vessel. Kosher is a very broad word, by the way. Kosher means no cheating, no desecration of Shabbos, you know, honesty in business. But it also means that it doesn't take away from what the person should be doing. You know, davening and learning and living the way you're supposed to live. That's when you have a kosher vessel. Why do we see so many people that cheat and are wealthy, and never the honest people are poor?
I was
going to
ask.
Yeah? Brilliant question. Mamma, brilliant question. Well, yet we see, not I asked it. So we see, so the question is, why is it that so many despicable people are so wealthy, low lives, and are so wealthy? First of all, as the Gemara uses the expression, don't mix into God's secret business. You don't know. Number one, you don't know where it's coming off from. You know? It could be coming off from Olam Haba, and God gives it to you in this world. You don't know where it's coming, what it's doing. Just, you know, trust God. But there's two issues. for the people that are despicable and wealthy, they shouldn't think I outsmarted God, because obviously we don't outsmart God, it's coming off somewhere. For the person who looks at them and says, hey man, look at this guy cheats, he's a lowlife, and look how wealthy it is. That is a test for us. In other words, the fact that Hashem made me aware that this guy cheats and he's wealthy, or seemingly, we don't know what's really doing inside their lives. Most of them are all messed up anyway. But outwardly, it looks like they live a life of luxury and leisure and everything else. For us, that's coming as a test from Hashem, that we shouldn't think to do it either. But Hashem has his calculations and his cheshbonos and his reckoning, how it works, it's not so simple. So this is what the Torah is telling us, these two stories. I mean, the connection between this story and the Menorah and the Mizbeach. The Menorah has to be Tahira, the Mizbeach has to be Tahira, the Shulchan has to be Tahira, the wisdom. Menorah, not wisdom, needs to be pure. You know, many people have an attitude, and this is human nature, by the way. If I don't understand it, it's wrong. Many people. That's called idol worshipping. They're worshipping their intellect. Pure intellect is to realize that my mind is only limited, and how could I understand Hashem? The question is not why I don't understand. The question is, how do I think I understand anything of Hashem that I think I do understand? That's the question. So it has to be pure. When it's pure, it works. Okay, so what happened over here like this?
What happened with him with his land? With her?
What?
With her and the land.
Okay, now there's another thing over here. The main Aveda the guy did. The main Aveda the guy did over here was he cursed God. Okay? Why does the Torah have to tell us they got into a fight? That's not relevant to the story. The relevant to the story is to teach us halacha, that God forbid, if somebody curses Hashem, then you get killed. Right? Why does the Torah have to give the introduction that they started fighting? So the Mefarshim explain, it says like this. If the two people would have discussed the thing rationally, instead of fighting, it wouldn't have come to the second sin. In other words, as they say, they bring down from Mechilta, of Reb Shimon Meichoi says, no good comes of strife. What happened to Avram and Light? There was a fight. Light separated himself from the tzaddik. Okay? And it says like this. The Klei Yoker adds to this, none of their names are mentioned. Not the guy whose mother was Jewish, and the other guy. It doesn't say their names in the Chumash. So the Klei Yoker says, why? Because anybody that fights is not worthy of their name being mentioned. Not worthy of their name being mentioned. And by the way, what's more interesting over here, the Jew seemingly was fighting good. Either he told them, listen, he won the court case. Moshe Rabbeinu said, you're out and you're right. You can't put your tent there. Or if the guy was telling him, why are you screaming that Hashem's eating old moldy bread, he didn't do anything wrong. But this is the Mefarshim don't say, but it's brought down in other places. The moral of the story is, if you're fighting, even when you're right, you're wrong. Anytime there's a fight, even if you're fighting right, you're also wrong.
What happened to his family? What happened to this man's family?
What happened to his family? What's wrong with his family? He gave her jewelry instead. And she was happy.
The story is like his mom is Jewish. belongs to be part of the Dan family, Dan tribe, and Moshe Rabbeinu judged and he refused.
He said, "You can't put your tent amongst the Shevet of Dan."
Okay, what the reason? Why not? Because mom is Jewish.
Because the Torah says the tribes went by the father. In other words, we discussed this once before, but it was a while ago, so I'll assume that we forgot it.
We did.
I also forgot it.
Just refresh me.
Judaism, religion, follows the mother. Mm-hmm. What type of Jew you are, i.e. Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, or which tribe, that follows the father. Correct? Mm-hmm. In childbirth, there's two people involved in the creation of a baby. It's called the father and the mother. The actual essence of the baby, which is being carried by the mother, that decides the essence of the baby, Jew or not Jew. The father basically is the one that reveals, without getting into it now, that reveals the power of giving birth that the mother has, is revealed through the father. Okay? So therefore, the revelation, the revealed part of the child, is dependent on the father. Mm-hmm. Therefore, Hashem says, whether you're Jewish or not, that is totally dependent on the mother. Because the essence of the child is carried by the essence of the mother that gave birth to them. Mm-hmm. So that follows the mother. The revealed part, what Shevet you belong to, including Kohen Levi Yisrael, whatever it may be, that is the revelation of the childbirth. So therefore that is the father. So therefore when you talk about tribes, the tribes go by the father. The father was from Dan, the kid's from Dan. The father's not from Dan, the kid's not from Dan. That's all.
So where does he go? Let's say all this didn't happen. He just follows all the tribes? He's in the back?
There was a separate place of people that didn't belong to any tribe.
Oh,
there
was. Okay.
Or somebody's father's not Jewish, the mother's Jewish, right? The kid's Jewish, mm-hmm. Right? Which tribe does he belong to? Forget a Ger, he's 100% Jewish. He's not even a Ger. Which tribe does he belong to?
Well,
no tribe.
Yeah.
Tribeless.
Israelite.
Yeah, but he's not Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. Or a Ger is a full-fledged Jew if he does a Kalacha, but he doesn't belong to any tribe.
So he would be in the tribe following the Geri.
Whatever, that's not a tribe, but that group, yeah.
I was just thinking it's interesting because back in Shemot, where Datan and Aviram were fighting, the Torah doesn't mention their names either.
Right.
Rashi says.
Right. Right. When the Torah speaks about fights, it doesn't say it. Correct. That's a good point. And Datan and Aviram, by the way, were brothers.
They're brothers?
Yeah.
It's a pasuk in Chumash. Vayikach Kairach, Ben Yitzhar, Ben Kohos, Ben Levi. The Dasan Vaviram Bnei Eliyav, Vein Ben Pelas Bnei Reuven. It's a pasuk in Chumash. Dasan Vaviram's father's name was Eliyav. It's a pasuk in Chumash. Parshas Kerach. Look at the first pasuk in Parshas Kerach. Veikach Kerach Ben Yitzhak Ben Kohos Ben Levi. Dasan Vaviram Bnei Eliyav. They're brothers. They have one father. Same father, Eliyav. If they had the same mother, I imagine they had the same mother. Maybe not, but they were mamish brothers.
So she was the wife of
Datan? No. Shlomis Bas Divri was, it doesn't say who her father was. I don't know who the husband was. No, his father was the Egyptian and may should have been killed. Rashi does not say his name. I don't know. Okay, let's continue. Okay. They put him into prison to find out what punishment. Here they did not know what the punishment was at all. There's a story later about the Mechal Shabbos that they knew that he gets death. They didn't know what type of death. Here, they actually didn't know. They didn't know what the punishment should be, so they waited for Hashem to tell Moshe Rabbeinu. Das Kainum over here explains that they thought maybe it's such a terrible sin that even a punishment wouldn't be good enough for him. Because what is punishment in Torah? Punishment in Torah is a cleansing process. So maybe this guy was so bad, such a terrible sin. By the way, this is one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. Is also that the guy is not allowed to curse God. It's one of the seven Noach laws. So they didn't know. So Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, no, he can get punished, he can get cleansed, he needs to get killed. But as a rule, it's another interesting concept. We don't have enough time to go through it now, but in Judaism, there is no prison sentence. In case you didn't know it. In Judaism, the whole concept of prison sentencing doesn't exist. Only in Goyish law. Internally, you get whipped, you get death, and that's it. There's no locking somebody up for prison. There's a whole sikha the Rebbe once spoke about. It's already printed. In English, it's also printed. The Rebbe once spoke, why isn't there a concept of jail time as a punishment? Here, they put him into prison just to hold him until they found out the ruling. But it wasn't a punishment. The punishment wasn't jail time. Okay? Mekesha Sheitzim was also put into prison because they didn't know what the punishment was. So until Hashem, but it wasn't, there was no such thing as punishment of jail time. And the Rebbe said, very interesting, it's late, but very briefly, the Rebbe said like this. A person is created for a purpose. A person's life has to be constructive. To take a person, lock him up, and not allow him to do anything constructive according to their ability is completely contrary to the whole concept of creation. The purpose of creation is for a person to make the world a better place. Okay? So the Rebbe was for rehabilitation, by the way. Rehabilitation. The Rebbe wanted, instead of jail term, they should do rehabilitate him. Rehabilitate him back into the system and let him lead a productive life. But the Rebbe said like this. In Torah law, it works like this. If a guy did a sin, then you can whip him and he'll learn his lesson, then go back into the world and function. Sometimes a guy does such a terrible sin, he loses the opportunity. Torah says, you lost the opportunity of being productive, and therefore you're killed. But to be in the world and not to be productive is a contradiction of terms. And that's why in Torah law, if you got the death sentence, you have to get killed that day. There's no death row that you, by the time they kill you, you're 120 years old anyway. Like in America. By the time they kill you, you're sick with cancer and you're dying anyway. In Torah law, they gave the verdict, that day you had to be killed.
What if somebody was, addicted to stealing? So how would you prevent this person from stealing?
Tie his hands.
Cuts his hands.
No, that's the Arabs do that. The Arabs and the Russians used to do that. Do you know that in Russia, if you killed somebody, they didn't care. If you stole, they would kill you.
I'm asking a question. How did they, in Jewish law, prevent people who were inclined to do negative things?
Because they rehabilitated them.
There were times that they locked somebody up. The marshal, there were cases, the Gemara says, a girl Nebuch that was mentally retarded. Okay? And all the men were taking advantage of her. So to protect the girl, they locked her up. But it wasn't a sentence.
They didn't lock the men up?
No, if they couldn't do anything.